your prime.
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction, or in this case, the movie Pulp Fiction. Directed by Quentin Tarantino, Pulp Fiction stars Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta, and Bruce Willis in what we assume is a very dark sequel to Look Who's Talking. Pulp Fiction is a wild ride, chock full of guns, gimps, and pocket watches that could use a little Purell. With me to discuss this, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon.
Just a quick note. I'm not able to record next week, so I'm going to suggest that we put out our Dune conversation next week.
Okay.
So if you're listening to this and you're expecting a Felonies and Fugazis film next week, we're going to take a break from that and put out our discussion on Dune 2, which may be a little late to have that conversation, but probably that film is just now available to purchase.
Yeah, I believe so.
At home viewing. Anyway, that'll be next week. And then the week after, we will return to our Felonies and Fugazis series. How about this one? You like that?
I like that.
I don't know why this is uploaded, but I don't hate it. What I want, you've got, it might be hard to handle. Like a flame that burns a candle. The candle feeds the flame. And what I got, full stop. I do not hate it at all. This song has my favorite shitty guitar solo.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He calls it out. He says, now listen to this. So he really wants you to listen to the guitar solo. Then what happens next? It's two notes. That's it. That's all it is. It's two notes.
Crazy that those two guys are fighting over that music.
Now listen to this. And it's just like, bam, bam. Really excited about that guitar solo.
It's like, man, you know what? I'm remembering this a little bit differently now that I hear it.
Yeah, those guys are really fighting over the artistic energy behind that song. Steve, do you want to start with anal rape or hamburgers for breakfast or feet? Which one of those?
Yeah, that's not the order I normally go in.
Now, have you ever had a burger for breakfast?
I didn't know we were going with that one. yeah, sure.
I think that's really the hot topic. Everyone wants to know.
I can't remember a specific time, but I think it would be like crazy if I've gone this many years and not had a burger for breakfast. I know I've gone to, like, you know, like on a road trip or something, and then you get to a place and they're like, well, we have burgers now. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah. It feels like to me it has to be like post 9 o'clock and you're just like,
well, I'm going to throw this out to you. Was it yesterday? Yesterday, I think it was. Maybe the day before. We had leftover turkey burgers, and my wife made a scramble with one of the leftover turkey burgers for breakfast.
But that includes count? Eggs. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, you can get a burger with an egg on it.
You're muddling the waters for sure.
You're saying an egg makes it breakfast?
So that's
because I got some fried rice that I want to talk to you about.
I feel like. Like if it's a breakfast burrito, there's egg involved, right?
Most of the time, yeah.
So if it's a breakfast burger, like, is there such a thing as a breakfast? Like if you're going to design a breakfast burger, it would absolutely have a fried egg on it, right?
Yeah, but you can get that any old time. You can get a Loco Moco in Hawaii, any old time.
Let me right? throw an idea at you, all right? So, you know, let's keep with the Hawaiian theme. Mm-hmm. The Hawaiian theme. Let's say you had a couple sweet buns, a hash brown, a beef patty, some cheddar cheese, and a fried egg. Would that be an appetizing breakfast?
Oh, absolutely.
I've never had it. Just made it up. I feel like I want it right now.
Since it's Big Kahuna Burger, I have to wonder, like, I mean, is it on a Hawaiian roll?
Looks like me and Vincent caught you boys at breakfast. Sorry about that. What'd you have?
Hamburgers.
Hamburgers! The cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast. What kind of hamburgers?
Cheeseburgers.
No. Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, where?
Big Kahuna Burger.
Big Kahuna Burger? That's that Hawaiian burger joint. I hear they got some tasty burgers. I ain't never had one myself. How are they?
I mean, I think that that's probably what happened with Big Kahuna Burger. They're like, well, okay, let's design a breakfast burger because we're going to be open early. We might as well have
it. How early is this,
they tried a few different things. They must have tried a few different things and then decided, what are we reinventing the wheel for? You know what? People like hamburgers. Let's just serve hamburgers and people can decide when they want to eat them.
So I think this is worth discussing because the whole movie, Pulp Fiction, plays with kind of timelines, right? At least in terms of how it presents itself. So, like, you have to do a little bit of reverse engineering to find out where things fall into place. Now,
I want you to say a lot more about this.
About the timeline?
I've got, like, notes and notes and notes on the use of time in this movie. But I want to hear your observations on this.
It's hard to know exactly what time anything is because every clock is set to 4:20. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I was thinking that every clock was set to heroin. That was my my impression.
So you've got in terms of like the time sequence, right? I mean, like it you have to your first scene, you know, of course, comes back. In the final scene, which is neither of those is actually the final moment in the timeline of this movie. The final, correct me if I'm wrong, the final moment in this movie is Zed's dead baby, right? In terms of the timeline.
If you were going to butcher this movie and reorder it so that the story ends at the most ultimate scene, Zed's dead baby is the end. But right, and that's this movie is bookended by breakfast.
Right. So I got to go back to that. They go to the apartment to meet up with Brad, right?
Brett.
Get the briefcase.
Yeah, Brett.
And they actually give themselves a little time because they're early. So they have a little bit of time. Sun's out. Then they go through that whole sequence.
It's not too early to start talking about foot fetishes, but let's continue with the line of thought.
So they've already purchased breakfast at Big Kahuna Burger.
Yes.
Big Kahuna Burger is open pretty early. Because then later we get, of course, the whole the Bonnie situation, which follows directly from this. And by the time they are done cleaning the car and getting ready to leave, they do a little bit of a hose down. And this is before Bonnie gets home at, 9?
Yeah.
How much time has gone by? How early is Big Kahuna Burger open?
Also Winston, the wolf.
He's at what party is he at?
He's at a black tie party. That's happening before noon. I mean, not even before noon. Probably before 10.
This is before 9. This is like before Bonnie gets home.
This is quite the party.
This is like a 7:30 party. A 7:30 a.m. party.
This is a black tie event. He's in a full tuxedo. It's going to be at my house. I want you to be at my house. Black tie event. We're going to start at 7:30 a.m. It's going to be gowns and tuxedos.
What's going on there? Like that's such an assumed moment, right? Like, I mean, Jimmy's in a robe. The wolf is in a tux. I mean, that's incredible to me. Is this like a pre-funeral party? Is there such a thing as that?
So my theory on this is that this movie is intentionally playing with time. And I think it all is in service to the idea that this is not linear. Nothing about this is linear. As we just mentioned, you end with Vincent Vega alive walking out of the diner in volleyball clothes and a 9mm in his elastic waist. Right. So he's not dead anymore. We saw him die earlier, but because this is a very pulpy approach to time, it doesn't really affect your enjoyment of that final scene. But in addition to that, what decade is this in? Because the hairstyles are from the 70s, and these are hitmen wearing black ties. They're wearing black suits and ties. That suggests like a 1940s gangster movie.
Mm-hmm.
They do a little time travel-y thing to Jack Rabbit Slims into the 50s. Esmeralda's old-timey cab looks like it's 40s or something like that. So there's just no realistic.
But Jules has a cell phone.
Jules has a cell phone for sure. No one else in the diner has a cell phone. Otherwise, that whole scene wouldn't work. This movie is sort of like consciously suggesting that it lives in every decade.
Or
it lives
none.
In the 40s. Yeah, or none. Like 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. It doesn't really matter. It could exist in any of them.
It serves almost as like a cinematic purgatory.
That's right. Even like down to like the breakfast cereal. Like at one point, Eric Stoltz is eating a breakfast cereal called Fruit Brute. Totally discontinued in the 90s.
Right.
This is a discontinued cereal.
Yeah, of the Count Chocula and the Frankenberry and Booberry life. People don't realize that there's a fruit.
It could be breakfast fruit!
I love Fruit Brute, my new fruit-flavored cereal.
I love Count Chocula.
I love Frankenberry.
But new Fruit Brute has fruit-flavored sweeties for the howling good taste.
Every season of Properly Howard has a werewolf in it. We absolutely have a werewolf on that cereal box.
Exactly. Werewolf cereal for sure.
Anyway, all that is to say that the timing in this movie it's like a shotgun. It's like scattered all over the place. And I think it's sort of intentional. It's like I don't care how this is going to play out in sort of linear space. What I care is how you feel in the moment and how you feel at the end of the film. And when I first watched this, I think I went to the theater 3 times to watch it. It was a revelation. Time is just one of the things he's playing with, but it does not necessarily make any sense. It doesn't matter that it doesn't make it.
Right. And again, obviously we have a watch, which is a central focal point of a movie that's messing with time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is interesting that the watch is introduced to us as having just left someone's colon. Leading us to another path, a colon-centric plot line.
This watch was on your daddy's wrist when he was shot down over Hanoi. He was captured, put in a Vietnamese prison camp. He knew that if the gooks ever saw the watch, it'd be confiscated, taken away. The way your dad looked at it, this watch was your birthright. He'd be damned if any slope's gonna put the greasy yellow hands on his boy's birthright, so he hid it. In one place he knew he could hide something, his ass. 5 long years he wore this watch, up his ass. Then he died of dysentery. Give me the watch. I hid this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my ass, 2 years. Then, after 7 years, I was sent home to my family, and now. Little man, I give the watch to you.
What is your history with this movie?
Saw it when it came out. I was had different reaction, I think, than you did. I mean, I was like, I didn't know what to think. Like, it was. I had never seen anything like it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like couldn't stop thinking about it, and I remember watching it with Heather when we were like, I think newly married, and I felt like guilty liking it as much as I did.
I remember a conversation with you about this. Yeah. We had not seen this together, but we were on the phone with each other. And you're like, yeah. I don't know how to feel, because my biggest laugh in the film was when the poor guy gets his head blown off.
Right, right.
And you felt a little guilty about that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I, for whatever reason, I didn't feel any guilt at all. I was just totally happy with every bit of this movie. Had you seen Reservoir Dogs yet?
No, I hadn't. So this movie, I think, kind of serves almost as a gateway for, at least for me, like in terms of reconciling the ability to find humor in Grimm and understanding how dark comedy can be, how glorious dialogue is, and what you can do to a scene, right? Yeah. Because I mean, there's like, I rewatching this, you know, I watch this all the time, but like, the overdose scene is hilarious. It's crazy. I mean, I remember when I first saw it, I was like, and it is, it's crazy intense. And it's like one of these movies, the more you watch it, like you appreciate the concept of the intensity when you had first seen it, but like, it's not intense anymore because you're just, I don't know how your experience is with it, but I just kind of marvel over it. But that sequence where he's with Travolta and Stoltz and they're trying to go through administering the shot, and like, Stoltz just like pumps his arm and he goes, okay, so I have to stab her three times. He's like, no, no, it's just like that whole sequence it's still super funny.
So this last time I was really focusing on Rosanna Arquette's face.
Oh yeah, she's so funny.
Because she's so pissed. Like the whole thing is putting her out and she's like yelling at Eric Stoltz and, you know, she's acting like you probably should act.
Right.
If someone brings someone into your living room who's about to OD, and then when she realizes what's going to happen, she just gets like this wicked fascination on her face. Like, what's going to happen now? And so as an audience member, you're like taking cues from the way that she feels about this whole thing. Like she's thinking, I might see someone actually die right here on my floor. It's a little bit exciting, or who knows what's gonna happen, right? So
if you're gonna wake me up, at least let me see something I've never seen before.
Right, gosh, this film is like, it's like haymaker after haymaker. It's like just a knockout scene and then you're on to the next one. And you're like, oh, geez, Christopher Walken just delivering the best Christopher Walken monologue you've ever seen. And then you're like, on the next scene, you're like, oh, my gosh, I get to watch Eric Stoltz and Travolta argue about this whole adrenaline shot. And then, oh, I get to watch the wolf. Oh, I love the scene with the wolf. There's no moment in this movie where you're like, oh, I wish I was with those other people.
Right.
Every bit of this movie is just a knockout punch.
I think when I first watched this movie a few times, like maybe I felt like the Butch plot was a little less than.
Okay, interesting. Oh, that's interesting because you're a big Bruce Willis guy.
Yeah, but and just in terms of like, because it's where the pace slows down, right? But like just rewatching it and listening to the whole like the boxing commentators in the background, like, well, he had to know that he killed him, you know, the way he looked, and then you find out he doesn't. But like, it's an interesting element, right? Like, so that's kind of telling you a little bit something about like their perception of him is, and what, like, so something obviously changed in the ring, right? Like he kind of it demonstrates that this Butch character maybe loses himself in this process. Right. Because the way that their commentators are talking about how, like, the way that he looked and the way he looked down, like, you knew he knew he killed him. And it's like, so maybe on some level he did, like, but like it, something comes out of him. Cause we see him, blow up, about the watch. Right. So there's obviously an element to this guy that is like, there's a flip or there's a switch that could be flipped and he's not necessarily maybe as aware or
right. He's got this sort of well of violence in him, mm-hmm. but he can be pretty, you know, he can put a good face on, right? You know, right. He can sit there and take it from Marcellus Wallace, or he can, like, you know, be playful with his girlfriend, or he can, you know, be super cool with the cab driver. But underneath it all, he's just a man of violence. Mm. And you kind of get to see him in real time, like, realize, I just killed a guy. So, you know, he's smoking a cigarette. She asks, what does it feel like to kill a man? And you, in real time, you can kind of see him realize, I don't feel anything. I don't feel guilty at all about just killing that guy. Which, of course, allows him to kind of almost become a samurai warrior by the end.
Right.
Let's talk about Travolta.
Sure.
We're at a unique place in the career of Travolta because I don't think that we were old enough to, like, really love his Welcome Back Cotter years, right?
Yeah, I don't think I had it. Like, my mom would reference it, like, if we watched something else with him, but I was like, well, whatever you say, weirdo, you know, like.
And then there was, like, a 4-year period where he was just on top of the world. He was the biggest star in the world, right? I mean, we missed all of that.
Well, I mean, how many times have you seen Grease, right? Like, when you were younger, I assume you've seen it a lot. I
was just talking with Sarah about this yesterday. Like, she's seen it a lot. I've maybe seen it 1.5 times. Like, really? All I know is that it's a super gross movie with John Travolta, who's pretty sexy. So, I mean, here's my first exposure to Travolta. It was Dana Carvey's impression of John Travolta on That's SNL. Funny. There's no way I was going to watch Saturday Night Fever. I was too young for that.
I never watched Saturday Night Fever, but I felt like I was aware of it enough, you know, and I was aware of Urban Cowboy. Like, I was aware of these things because they, I mean, maybe because I, you know, I had an older sister who may have been interested. I had seen The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of, like, odd ones that I watched. There was Two of a Kind. Two of a Kind, the other one with Olivia Newton-John, where I think it has something to do with, like, God and some angels trying to orchestrate their lives or something.
It sounds right up my alley. He says with a question mark. I've never seen this. I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, there's no necessarily reason to have. It's crazy that, like, that's one of the ones that I remember having seen. And I think the reason why it really stands out is because Separate Ways by Journey, I believe, was featured prominently in Two of a Kind. It's funny because, like, Travolta was like an entity, right? Like, he was a concept. Like, I hadn't seen Carrie at this point. I for sure didn't see Perfect with Jamie Lee Curtis, which is now a wonderful, you know, meme. But yeah, I don't think I watched Saturday Night Fever until, like, way later. So really,
everything
it was
that you just mentioned, like, half of those I've never heard of before. And so,
really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot there that I am not familiar with.
You never saw The Boy in the Plastic Bubble?
Should I? I
mean, are we doing a Travolta season? Two of a Kind is four angels, played by Charles Durning, Scatman Crothers, Castula Guerra, and Beatrice Strait have been in charge of heaven for the last 25 years. They are playing a golf match in heaven when their game is interrupted by God, voiced by Gene Hackman, who has returned to the office and does not like what he sees down on Earth. God wants to order up another flood and start all over again, despite his promise in the rainbow that he never would again. But the four angels persuade him to reconsider, reasoning that if a typical earth man can reform, it would prove that all mankind is capable of it. God agrees to the scheme, and the typical earth man selected by the angels is Zach Mellon, played by John Travolta, a failed inventor who, threatened by loan sharks, decides to hold up a bank. Zach points his gun at bank teller Debbie Wilder, Olivia Newton-John, who ostensibly gives him all the money. However, when Zach peers into the sack after the robbery, he sees that Debbie has substituted bank deposit slips for the cash and has kept the money for herself. Zach tracks her down to reclaim his stolen money while dodging the loan sharks and the evil interventions of the devil, played by Oliver Reed. The two come to develop a romantic relationship, which is put to the test when they are threatened by a masked thug. Now, that doesn't sound crazier than a lot of Old Testament stuff.
I was just going to say, this sounds like the book of Job, but instead of Job, you've got an anti-hero. That sounds amazing to me. I feel like I need to watch this tonight. What is this called again?
Two of a Kind.
Why name it Two of a Kind?
Well, it was originally going to be called...
That's the worst name for what you just described.
It was originally going to be called Second Chance.
That sounds a lot better.
It sounds better.
All right, so let's say a decade of a pretty underwhelming work. So much so that Tarantino has to fight for Travolta to be in this movie. He's just totally committed to the idea that Vincent Vega must be played by John Travolta. He's even willing to pull it from Miramax. If they don't give him Travolta, they're trying to foist upon him Daniel Day-Lewis.
Really?
Yes. Tarantino says, no way. I do not want anyone but Travolta.
Could you imagine?
So, no, I can't imagine.
You better be right. You know what I mean?
I don't want the guy from My Left Foot. Give me the guy from Urban Cowboy.
Totally. You ever see Two of a Kind, Chief?
I mean, that's kind of impressive. And he, you know, Tarantino's kind of become known for, like, you know, giving someone a second career.
Tarantino's not Tarantino yet, right?
I mean, that's right. So. No, I'm sorry. No Daniel Day-Lewis. I want Travolta. He's so in love with John Travolta that he is living in his old apartment. Did you know this?
No.
This is before he's rich and famous or anything. He's living in John Travolta's old apartment building, maybe even the same apartment as John Travolta. Invites John Travolta up. You know, when he thinks he's going to get cast, plays some board games with him. Sorry, Daniel Day-Lewis. Bruce Willis would have been interested in the role. Nope. We want Travolta. And I think it's better with John Travolta. I mean...
Yeah, well, this movie, as it is constructed, I think is better. I mean, it's hard to imagine not Travolta. I mean, I could imagine Daniel Day-Lewis becoming John Travolta and everybody believes it. But this movie absolutely feels like it requires John Travolta.
What did you think about what happened to Antoine?
Who's Antoine?
Tony Rocky Horror. You know him.
He fell out of a window.
Well, that is one way to say it. Another way to say it would be that he was thrown out. Another way would be was he was thrown out by Marcellus. And yet even another way is to say he was thrown out of a window by Marcellus because of you.
Is that a fact?
No, it's not a fact. It's just what I heard.
Who told you?
They.
They talk a lot, don't they?
They certainly do.
Don't be shy, Vincent. What else did they say?
Well, I'm not shy.
Did it involve the F word?
No. They just said that Antoine had given you a foot massage.
And?
And nothing. That's it.
You heard Marsalis threw Tony Rocky Horror out a four-story window for giving me a foot massage?
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe that?
Well, I mean, at the time I was told, it sounded reasonable.
Marsalis throwing Tony out of a four-story window for massaging my feet seemed reasonable.
No, it seemed excessive, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
of course, because this movie's become what it is, it's almost impossible to think of someone else in this role.
Right.
But the
thing that's crazy is that they still got Daniel Day-Lewis to play the Gimp, and it's wild that he's uncredited, but unbelievable how he just dissolves into that character.
He can't go to sleep unless he's wearing the leather suit now. And he's got to be in that box.
That's why they had to zip his mouth shut, because every time they unzipped it, he was going, "Drainage!"
I love this movie for its theology.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've seen you speak to it quite a bit.
Yeah, I really love this part of it, and it's interesting because it's kind of a movie best known for the amount of sin that is in this. Like, if you want a movie about like different kinds of sin, Pulp Fiction is absolutely, you're going to see a lot of varieties of that in this movie. But I've always loved that part of it. And because I think that there is a legit, religious experience in this movie and leading to a conversion experience. And there's, you again, in real time, you get to see the character try to talk through this new religious reality he's stepping into. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's really well done. I think it's someone who clearly knows what he's talking about. Feels very authentic to me. And in a movie that feels very surreal in a lot of other ways, the Jules character, you never get the sense that he doesn't believe what he's saying.
Oh, man, that's good. That's good, man. You're not starting to lighten up. You've been sitting there all serious and shit.
Oh, man, I've just been sitting here thinking.
About what?
About the miracle we witnessed.
Miracle you witnessed. I witnessed a freak occurrence.
What is a miracle, Vincent?
Act of God.
And what's an act of God?
When God makes the impossible possible. But this morning, I don't think qualifies.
Hey, Vincent, don't you see that shit don't matter? You're judging this shit the wrong way. I mean, it could be God stopped the bullets, or he changed Coke to Pepsi, he found my fucking car keys. You don't judge shit like this based on merit. Now, whether or not what we experienced was an according to Hoyle miracle is insignificant. But what is significant is I felt the touch of God. God got involved.
But why?
Well, that's what's fucking with me. I don't know why. But I can't go back to sleep.
You serious? You really thinking about quitting?
The life?
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Fuck.
You have three key theological moments, right? In these three sort of vignettes that are key, right? So you have Jules's conversion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big moment.
I felt the touch of God.
Yeah, you've got Butch receiving grace.
He actually drives away on a motorcycle called Grace.
It's not a motorcycle, baby. It's a chopper.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I know there's been a lot of discussions, like, different critiques and deep dives that suggest that Marcellus Wallace is like, he's the devil, but because of the 666
right,
and the briefcase.
Sure.
But I would suggest that maybe he's more of a God figure in this.
Interesting.
And then you have the other scene, which is a resurrection.
Oh, where's the resurrection?
Mia Wallace.
So that's interesting because you could almost say that Vincent Vega is resurrected because you see him die in the bathroom midway through the film. And then Tarantino resurrects him in the next scene.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But when they basically keep, he brings her back to life when she's basically dead to rights.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot. Now, the other part of this that I love is that Jules is always quoting this verse from Ezekiel. I just thought it was some cold blooded shit that I said right before I pop a cap in someone's ass. And then he has this experience, and now he has to reinterpret what the verse means and sort of rearrange the metaphors. and he realizes, I am the tyranny of evil men. But in order for my life to have meaning, I've got to be the shepherd. I've got to go live this kind of pilgrim experience. I came from Kung Fu, where I go around, walk around, and get in adventures and help people that need help. Almost an Eastern point of view. And of course, it's the call out from Kane from Kung Fu. But it's sort of like very anti-materialistic, you know, very altruistic, you know, emptying of ego. But it's also very kind of like 1970s television, right? Like, right. Like all, like Kane, but you also got the Incredible Hulk, or you've got Highway to Heaven. You know, you've got all of these other, these shows where every week someone who's traveling around America meets someone else that needs their help. You know, we could probably name a dozen shows that had that premise.
Right.
So Tarantino's drawing from religion, but it's in service to this really kind of childhood pop culture idea of the world.
Well, and then the misreading or the misquoting of the scripture, I think, is important too, because he knows it by heart, but he knows it wrong.
Yeah, all right.
Which I think is an interesting element of maybe the theological approach that even Tarantino is taking in this, right? Because he's taking some theological liberties. Why not take some liberties with the verse itself? And
yeah, the verse itself is pulp, right? It's sort of like right. this distorted version. But also you could say that that's how people approach religion, right? They exactly. memorize it rigidly wrong.
Right. And more importantly, I think, apply it into the life that they want to live.
Right.
Find me a verse that justifies my actions. And
sure.
In this particular case, he's memorized it incorrectly. He's applied it to his life because he thinks it sounds badass. Now he's reinterpreting the already misinterpreted verse to then go with his new found lifestyle and choice, right? And I think and in that in and of itself is what he's suggesting when he says God got involved. It's an interesting element, this whole idea of that God getting involved. And if you go back to that sort of Marcellus Wallace character, who's going to get me out of this jam? So what does he do? He gets on the phone and he's talking to Marcellus Wallace.
Yeah.
And Marcellus Wallace isn't really giving him the answers he wants. And he's like, look, I just want you to tell me that it's going to be taken care of.
Right.
How many prayers are that? Right.
Right. That makes sense.
And so Marcellus Wallace is like, hey, I'm going to send you an angel. I'm going to send you the wolf.
Right.
And, so this whole, I think it's a really fascinating thing where, you know, Marcellus Wallace is giving Butch, you know, instructions. Basically, I'm asking you to humble yourself. I am asking you to do what you think is the unthinkable for my will. And then later, even though that's broken because of circumstances, because Butch shows himself put in a situation where he could have abandoned his God, but he came back to defend. He was offered grace.
I like that. The scene with Maynard and Zed, that absolutely is hell.
Mm-hmm.
From Willis's perspective, he has to become righteous. He has to become someone who has at least a little bit of honor, which is actually why he chooses the samurai sword. What tradition can we draw from that considers, you know, the idea of killing with honor? You know, you don't kill someone with a chainsaw. You know, you don't kill someone with a baseball bat. You kill someone with a samurai sword. A samurai has honor. And so he chooses right. that path. And I mean, that to me, I don't necessarily need it all to make sense theologically, but in the world of this film, it's fascinating.
Well, and here's where I'm going to take it even further. The idea of like, oh, well, it doesn't have to make sense theologically because, you know, I'm just enjoying it for what it is. And this is this film's version of theology. You could take it a step further and say, look, this is how we always reconcile theology. You know, if you, I know that this part might sort of undercut this part.
Right.
And let's not talk about that one right now.
Yeah, or that part's a paradox. You just have to accept that part by faith. This is the important part over here.
Yeah, this was all a metaphor. This really happened. Here's how I mapped it out. You know, trying to find a serial killer. You just have all these different strands that connect to somewhere. And at the end of it, it's like, oh, well, there's grace. Because you see that too with even the Tony Rocca horror story, right? This is why Marcellus Wallace made the decision he did. And Mia breaks it down, basically suggesting, look, we do not understand why Marcellus Wallace does what Marcellus Wallace
Interesting.
Does.
Interesting. Huh.
And it's not for us to necessarily know. But what do? We fill in the blanks and we create these narratives. And
I like that a lot. So a couple connections with other Tarantino films. I guess Vincent Vega is supposed to be Mr. Blonde's brother.
Correct.
So Mr. Blonde is a character in Reservoir Dogs. You got the samurai sword, right?
Right.
Which connects you to Kill Bill. And at one point, Bill's brother in volume 2 says that he hawked his Hanzo sword at a secondhand
store, which is actually
where he finds the seminar. Now, we know that he didn't do it because the bride finds it, but it's almost like this alternate reality where he did hawk it just for Bruce Willis to find it and use it. Interestingly, in that show, there's this idea that, this blade is so sharp that even if you met God, God would be cut.
Right.
I love that line. Set in L.A., kind of a surrealistic L.A. This is, in the same way that he plays with time, the geography doesn't quite work in this movie, but it doesn't really matter.
Right.
There's no traffic. There's hardly any traffic in this L.A.
Right. And that's why I look at it sort of, it feels like a purgatory type, like they're all already condemned.
Huh.
Right. It's they don't know where they are existing in time or in space. Right. It's just, it's such an effective way to tell a story, more than just being an interesting thing to do. Right. Oh, that's different. Cause it was, I think that's the first reaction is well, that's different. But it's also what it does is that when you see it and you don't know about the time situation until maybe after, because you will have a moment wait, isn't he dead? And you're like, wait, why are they in the clothes? Oh, wait. And then, so then when you make the connection, you go, wow, I just watched a movie that just completely disrupted time
mm-hmm.
for apparently no reason. Yet I didn't have a problem with it. Whenever you see, I don't know if you've ever seen the memes where people take the words and then they misspell them. But they misspell them in such a way that you can still read it, and it's almost kind of feels like it's doing that kind of a trick. And so it effectively tells you, this time is a construct and you might not, what you think you need to be able to understand these things is not maybe what you really need.
Let me ask you something. When did you make this decision? When you were sitting there eating that muffin?
Well, yeah. I was sitting there eating my muffin and drinking my coffee and replaying the incident in my head when I had what alcoholics refer to as a moment of clarity.
One of the interesting things about this that I like is that it does a bit of an homage to 1970s crime dramas. But the thing that marks 70s crime drama was the hyper-realism that it was trying to put on the screen. And this film is extremely surrealistic. So we already talked about the time thing, right?
Right.
But the dialogue, this is not how real people talk. It's almost like someone walks in the room with this pre-rehearsed monologue. And it's sort of perfectly delivered with a perfect kind of curated deep cut needle drop, the perfect lighting. The perfect, the camera work is always framed in such a way that you're always reminded that you're watching a movie. He doesn't really want you to get lost in the world as much as just to kind of sit back and admire the artistry of this. He throws in these stylistic flourishes that, you know, maybe couldn't work in a previous film. It's like there's this moment where Uma Thurman is outside of Jack Rabbit Slim's and she's telling Travolta not to be a square.
Mm-hmm.
And she creates a imaginary square in the air.
Right.
That disappears like magic. And then he just moves on. It's right. Like you wouldn't find that in a 70s crime drama, right?
Right. And it does cause you a moment of like, wait, what? why did that happen?
He doesn't do it anywhere else in the film, but you know, maybe it's like we know he's on drugs, so maybe it's from his perspective. You know, maybe this is sort of a heroin fueled perception of everything going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in many ways, his films, or he has multiple films, I think, and especially this one, that sort of work almost as like a pastiche in a way, right? Like it's a collection of styles that he's, you know, sort of recreating.
I do like that, that there are certain roles in this film that he had in mind for specific people. So the wolf was always supposed to be Harvey Keitel, right?
Mm.
But he kind of had the idea of Lawrence Fishburne for the Jules character.
Interesting.
Doing an interview in New York almost 20 years ago, and a woman from Texas came up and interrupted the interview. And
I don't mean to bother you, but can I have your autograph, Mr. Jackson?
And so I gave her, I wrote, you know, blah, 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 Sam Jackson.
Yeah.
And so Sam and I have this running gag about
Can this film work if it's Lawrence Fishburne?
I mean, I think it can. It's just going to work differently. The Samuel L. Jackson flair is not there, but I think he could certainly deliver elements of the gravitas of the conversion.
Yeah.
But sometimes I can find Lawrence Fishburne to be a little bit campy.
Well, I mean, it's not like Samuel L. Jackson doesn't do camp at times, right?
Right. But it feels like that's who he is.
Well, and for us, well, at least for me, that was the first time I'd ever saw him on the screen.
Mm.
And so for me, that actor is always that character. But for, I think for like people of my children's generation, it's Fury. Right. He's the guy that brings together the Avengers.
Sure.
How many movies was he in where he was Fury? He was like 12 movies or something around that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot. I'm trying to think. I had experienced, and I knew he was in, Jurassic Park, obviously. I did not like watch that and go, oh yeah, he was from Goodfellas.
Right.
Or he was the guy that robbed the McDowells from Coming to America.
I feel like if there's anything that you would probably know him from, it would probably be Jurassic Park at this point, just because of how huge that movie was. But this character is just so much more memorable. But I was going to ask you this. Is there a main character in this film?
It's funny because Travolta gets the best actor nod.
Well, and also he is connected to more of the storylines than anyone else, I think.
Right, right, yeah.
So I guess you could say that he's the main character, but...
But in the Butch one, he's not in it very much. He just dies on the toilet.
He's not in it very much, but the Butch character is how he dies. And he does have an interaction with him at the bar.
Right, Palooka.
Beforehand, yeah.
Punchy.
But you know, so Travolta is sort of, I guess if you were going to come up with a main character, it's Travolta. But for me, the most memorable performances are Sam Jackson and Bruce Willis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Sam Jackson gets nominated for the, supporting actor. But if you, you know, on, upon rewatch, it really does feel like Travolta supporting Jackson, in my opinion. And Samuel
and
Jackson.
Because of the way it ends, it's like it's this big conversion experience at the end. He delivers this major monologue. He's larger than life.
Jules, you give that fucking Nimrod $1,500 and I'll shoot him on general principle.
No, Yolanda, Yolanda, he ain't gonna do a goddamn motherfucking thing. Vince, shut the fuck up!
Shut up!
Come on, Yolanda, stay with me, baby. Now, I ain't giving it to him, Vincent. I'm buying something for my money. Wanna know what I'm buying, Ringo?
What?
Your life. I'm giving you that money so I don't have to kill your ass. You read the Bible, Ringo?
Not regularly, no.
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness. For he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon you. I've been saying that shit for years. And if you heard it, that meant your ass. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was some cold-blooded shit to say to a motherfucker before I popped a cap in his ass. But I saw some shit this morning made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man, and I'm the righteous man. And Mr. 9mm here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous ass in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man, and I'm the shepherd. And it's the world that's evil and selfish. Now, I'd like that. But that shit ain't the truth. The truth is, you're the weak. And I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
Well, he's got more monologues than anybody, right? I mean...
Right. And he doesn't die. He gets to survive.
Yeah, and he really, I mean, he really moves. He moves, I mean, especially the sequence during the bulk of the Bonnie situation, where, you know, he's very angry at Travolta, even though, because Travolta doesn't have lava, but.
Man, that scene makes me laugh every time. What are the funniest scenes in this for you? Because I could probably name 10 that I just can't.
Yeah, I love almost all the. I mean, the Bonnie situation is pretty fantastic. I mean, obviously that's the whole end of the movie, but I mean, I look at that mostly as just that them in the house. I think the part that maybe makes me laugh the hardest every single time is when the wolf gets his coffee, takes a sip, stops, turns around, and gives him a little, hey, it's pretty good coffee look.
It's almost out of a commercial.
Yeah, I get giddy for it every time. It's so value added. It's such a fun callback to kind of a throwaway mm-hmm. sequence of talking about, you know, it gets freeze dried taster's choice, but
I love that. I also love that when they're kind of like rolling through the scenario of what if Bonnie does come home and sees them moving a dead body
so
around.
Funny. It's such a goofy moment. It's like a rare goofy moment in the film.
They're all kind of like a little bit like hunched over, like they don't quite have a good grasp on right. the body, and they look up like they're, you know, children caught with their hand in the cookie jar right. or something. It's just so hilarious.
The Winston Wolf writing down body, no head.
Oh man!
I mean, there's a lot. I mean, so that stuff. I mean, again, the OD scene is hysterical. I mean, obviously, I mean, there's really bizarre humor in the whole watch monologue. Even the tension of you know, with talking about Kahuna Burgers, and
there are a number of scenes in this movie that are just laugh out loud funny, and it makes me wonder, is this a comedy?
Right. Yeah. I would say, I mean, I can't imagine a movie that makes me laugh this much not being a comedy.
All right. Then is this the best comedy?
That's a really good question. I mean, that's an interesting...
Because if this is a comedy, it's got to be one of the best ever made.
Right? Yeah. No, that's a good point, because it's rare to have a movie of this caliber, period. And if it's a comedy, then yeah, wouldn't that have to elevate it? Because what to make the humor out of those sequences and any of those moments, if you're just to read about what they are on paper, you'd be like, well, there's no way that's funny.
So the scene where they're cleaning up the brain and skull in the car is maybe one of the funniest scenes ever in a movie. Yeah. The interactions between Jackson and Travolta in that, where they're both just so angry at each other.
I'm drying my hands.
Well, you're supposed to wash them first.
Well, you watch me wash them.
I watched you get them wet.
How would you describe that? Tonally, there's 100 versions of that scene that don't work. But for whatever reason, the way that it's placed and the way it's delivered in this movie makes it hilarious.
Yeah. Brain detail is an amazing line.
Brain details. Oh my gosh. All right. Is there a trope that you like?
I'm kind of a sucker for a MacGuffin.
Yeah.
And I'm a sucker for swords.
Good samurai sword scene. It's fantastic.
The diner's amazing, by the way. Like just the whole setting of the diner. It's amazing how the scene is so so dramatic and so intense, and he's in this like t-shirt with this jerry curl, and then behind him is like this faux stone of a diner we've all been to, and it's just it's incredible that that's like, he does a really good job of making you feel like, you know, you've been to these diners, so anybody can show up in there. And it's like the idea that there were these two hitmen that were dressed like that because of a series of circumstances. So it's just the use of the everyday.
By the way, that's Sarah loves that scene so much because Amanda Plummer's physical comedy in that scene is so brilliant.
Oh, so good. Like at one point,
the way that she's sliding in the background, like swinging the gun around.
The way she puts the one hand with no gun, and it almost looks like she's trying to point it at, like, she's got one on Travolta now, and then she just has an empty hand pointed, and it's this idea of just like panic. It seems so genuine.
She's so amazing. You just hear in the background, shoot him in the face.
And then when he opens it, he's like, "Is that what I think is? What is it?" You know, she goes through so many different emotions.
Oh, she's so perfect for that scene. Oh my gosh. So the trope that I like is, I like it when directors put themselves in the movie, even if it's a minor role. And I think for some people, they hate it, you're Hitchcock, you know, like, oh, you think you're so good. And I remember back in the day when I watched this, my girlfriend at the time thought that Tarantino was just a horrible actor and he should have never put himself in the movie. I think he's great. What do you think about Tarantino in this?
That would be this would be my tweak.
Oh, you would rather have someone else in that role?
Yeah, because there's a couple of moments where he does disrupt the timing, and I forgive it a lot because of the dialogue and the overall sense of the scene. Heather, not a fan of Tarantino's acting. You put Steve Buscemi in this role, and it's otherworldly.
Interesting. So
Buscemi giving that whole conversation about coffee would be dynamite.
Interesting. What do you think about Butch's girlfriend? Some people really hate her performance in this.
I could definitely see how some people might feel like she's the girlfriend from Caddyshack type of a disruption. I think it works because of what they've done with the Butch character. Like, she's kind of dumb.
She might be a little bit dumb, but she's also like culturally unaware. Like, she, like, you get the sense like she's younger, she's from France, she certainly doesn't know how the world of crime works, right?
Right.
So it's not necessarily an intelligence thing. It's just that she's kind of innocent to this gritty culture that
she's a sociopath who loves pancakes. She has to, however you define her, who do you think is going to be going on this journey with Butch? You know what I mean? Like who's going with Butch? Who's going to stick around because he lost his ass watch? You know what I mean? Like, there's an element of that kind of makes sense in this. Like, do you think he's going to have a strong counterpart with him? You know, this is a highly risky plan that he goes through, and he's messing with the wrong guy, and it takes a wrong turn at Zed's to get out of it. He would have been hunted forever. In the same way that maybe she's misguided and naive, you could make the same argument about Butch.
She's willing to like throw her life away and run around the world with him, go on the lam, become a fugitive. So, you know, maybe she's just attracted to guys that are not good for her or something like that.
Right. Well, she doesn't like it when he does the voice, though. She does at least draw some boundaries.
She does not like the Mongoloid voice. My wife thinks that she's hilarious. She just loves the scene so much. All of their scenes together. And I die laughing when she's finally standing next to the chopper and she just starts crying, and he realizes, if I'm going to get her on the back of this thing, I'm going to have to stop and ask her how her breakfast
went. Right.
It's just the perfect way to end that little, that character's story. Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
Oh yeah. Look, with all due respect to Howard, I mean, come on. There's only one person that could make this.
If Howard does this film, is the character Fonzie referenced?
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. They may have changed it to Vinnie Barbarino.
Sure. For me, this is a Howard plus 12.
Yeah, I was going to go Howard plus 11, so we're not too far off.
All right. This is definitely the highest. I think this is the highest rating that we've given a movie. Is there a half the battle, one to grow on moment in this film?
Be careful out there, kids.
I was thinking, if you go to the bathroom, expect the worst.
I always do.
a cocoon of horror.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the 4th be with you all month and beyond.